This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. His name immediately evokes what to many seems a curious hobby, birdwatching. But John James Audubon was a birdwatcher like no other. A colorful figure who was known to lie about the details of his own life, Audubon roamed through the backwoods of America in the early 1800s, searching for a truth of nature, tracking down, studying, and drawing the birds he found there. He collected those drawings in his book, The Birds of America, a four-volume set of life-size portraits of birds in their natural environment. His work made a lasting imprint on the natural sciences, and the story of his life provides a window into America at a time when flocks of birds sometimes darkened the skies. Today on Talk of the Nation, John James Audubon and the making of The Birds of America. Later in the program, competition birding style, but first, the life and legacy of John James Audubon. If you have any questions about Audubon himself or his accomplishments, give us a call. If you're a birder, how do you assess his book? Is there something about a drawing that can evoke more than a photograph? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@npr.org. Joining us now from studios at Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul is William Souter. He is author of the book Under a Wild Sky, John James Audubon and the Making of Birds of America. Thanks so much for being with us today, Mr. Souter.
Hi, Lynn. Happy 4th of July weekend.
Thank you. One of the things that I really was fascinated by in this book was something that when I thought about it, I thought, well, it should have been obvious. But for some reason, this book really made me think about what America was like in the early 19th century. And I think one of the stories that really illustrated that so strongly for me was the story of the passenger pigeons. I wonder if you could start off by telling us that story, which is so revealing about how different wildlife was at that time.
Sure. Well, Lynn, you're talking about something that happened to Audubon in 1813 when he was traveling by horseback from the little town of Henderson, Kentucky, on the Ohio River, where he lived with his wife and his two sons. He was on his way to Louisville when he saw what he thought at first was a dark cloud on the horizon. And he got down from his horse and watched, and after a few minutes it became clear to him that this was, in fact, a flock of passenger pigeons coming straight at him. He spent the next several minutes trying to determine whether there were multiple flocks of birds or whether it was all one group of birds. And eventually, as this enormous column, like a river of birds, began to pass directly overhead and span the sky from one horizon to the next, Audubon realized that he was looking at a single group of birds that was in transit, probably looking for food. It was the middle of the day, and the sky got dark, and pigeon dropping started to fall like snow.
Which is not a very appealing image, I have to say.
Perhaps not. To Audubon, Audubon was never happier than to be in the midst of the wildest places in America and the wildest things that America had to offer, which were substantial at that time. So I don't imagine he was bothered too much. I'm sure he was much more fascinated by these incredible numbers of passenger pigeons passing overhead. He traveled on to Louisville that day, riding along underneath this flock the entire time, found that in Louisville the birds were passing low over the Ohio River, and that the citizens of Louisville were out eagerly hunting them. It took a total of 3 days for this one flock, this single flock of birds, to pass overhead, day and night, 3 days in a row. And although we can't be absolutely certain of these numbers, because, of course, the passenger pigeon went extinct before we could verify the observations that Audubon made, but based on his calculations of the speed and the density at which passenger pigeons traveled, there could have been more than 20 billion birds in that one flock that took 3 days to pass overhead.
And of course, the people of that time couldn't possibly imagine that that bird would someday be extinct.
Well, Audubon certainly couldn't imagine it. Even though passenger pigeons were aggressively hunted, when a flock would land in an area, there was a great devastation that followed. The pigeons themselves would tend to kind of wreak havoc havoc on the forest just by the weight of their bodies settling into the trees and splintering off limbs and making kind of a tremendous mess of things. This would draw people in from the surrounding area to hunt the birds for as long as they were in the area. Audubon thought that despite this kind of slaughter, that hunting would never diminish pigeon numbers. He was concerned, though, and the one aspect of Audubon's field work that sort of suggests what we might recognize as a more modern conservation ethic, he did recognize that destroying the habitat, that eliminating the forest by cutting it down and clearing the land would someday perhaps have an impact on the numbers of passenger pigeons. But there were so many of these birds that it seemed inconceivable in Audubon's time that they would ever be gone entirely.
Now, he came to this country from France, and part of what he found, the appeal for him in this country, was this kind of wildness, as you said. There's something like the pigeons, but that multiplied by many times of the kinds of birds that he could find here.
Well, Audubon had a great passion for nature and for wild places, even as a young boy growing up in France. He was actually born originally in Haiti. It had a different name then. It was a French colony. It was a very well-to-do colony at the time. But he grew up in France, and he came to live just outside of Philadelphia on a farm that his father owned there. His father was a French sea captain. And Audubon was immediately in love with his new country and completely smitten with the abundance of wildlife that there was in the forests surrounding Philadelphia. But of course, at that time, and this is 1803, the same year that Lewis and Clark, you know, head to the west to explore the rest of the continent, most of the European settlers that have come to North America are still clinging to the eastern seaboard. They're living in a narrow band of civilization, as they understand it, that's really right along the Atlantic Ocean. And it really isn't until the beginning of the 1800s that Audubon and other people like him began to travel in great numbers across the mountains and into what was then the frontier of America, which was, of course, already inhabited by Native Americans. But this was really the first influx of European settlers to come into the country. And what they found there was something different than what we see now. You know, we think of a forest today as a discrete object or a discrete thing that exists across a range or in a location. In those days, the forest was everywhere. In the eastern half of the United States was all forest, all towering trees, really without end, interrupted only by game trails and perhaps a few footpaths that that Native Americans had worn through the wilderness. But by and large, it was an endless forest for as far as you could see and as far as you could travel. And to Audubon, this was paradise because he loved the birds and the animals that lived in that forest.
Yeah, and he was a very colorful character. And America at that time was a place where a man like Audubon could pretend to be something he wasn't. He was not always completely truthful about his own life.
Well, he was the illegitimate son of his father. The sea captain had a mistress in Haiti who had died shortly after Audubon's birth. And one of the things that his father instructed him to do when he got to the New World, which was to not tell anybody the exact circumstances of his birth. And so Audubon had had initial instructions in this regard. He was also looking to stay out of Napoleon's army by coming to America. And so he had several cover stories that he used sort of interchangeably about exactly who he was and where he came from. And then over time, during his years in Kentucky, he kind of picked up a Kentucky storyteller's penchant for embellishing the facts or making things up when it suited his purposes. He really preferred a better story than the absolute truth sometimes. That's not to say that his ornithological studies were not scrupulous. I think they were. I think he was unfailingly accurate and stuck close to the truth when he was talking about birds. But when he was talking about his own exploits, whether it was hunting with Daniel Boone, which he claimed to have done, and I suspect he never, in fact, did, things like that, he was ready and willing to make up a good story.
He sounds like he was quite a character.
I think
he was. Yeah, we're talking about the life of John James Audubon, and we are taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, and we're going to take a call now from Amos in, I think it's Novelty, Ohio.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. Go ahead, Amos.
My question is, I've heard that Audubon was not just a great bird watcher, but a great hunter as well. And is there any truth to that?
Amos, there's a lot of truth to that. Audubon was an enthusiastic bird hunter. I believe that really is the origin of his interest in birds. He did love to hunt them. He did that because he liked it. He did that because many, many people, if not most people, did at the time. Certainly by the time he got to the American frontier, people hunted to put food on the table. Audubon also hunted because he didn't have a camera. He didn't have any kind of modern optics. He didn't have any way to look at birds up close other than to shoot them and actually, you know, be able to hold on to them and inspect them closely. So it was a necessity for Audubon to hunt birds for several reasons. But that's not to say that he didn't enjoy doing it, and he certainly was a prolific and at times indiscriminate hunter of birds.
Thanks for your call, Amos.
Thank you.
I found that interesting and a little ironic, given that his name now, of course, is almost synonymous with conservation. And as Amos pointed out, I think bird watchers now take great pride in the fact that they watch and do not hunt.
This is the one fact that people seem to know about Audubon, if they don't really know much else about him, is that he shot his birds. And to many modern sensibilities, that's a little bit troubling. I really don't think it's inconsistent. We should perhaps point out that the Audubon Society really didn't have anything to do with Audubon other than it borrowed his name. It was formed about a half a century after Audubon died by someone who was an Audubon fancier. I think if Audubon were alive today by some circumstance, I think that he would share in a the sort of conservation ethic that we associate with the Audubon Society, and I think he would be a much more careful bird hunter. But I suppose in fairness we should point out that ornithologists today still shoot birds so that they can inspect them closely. And, of course, now they're able to look at DNA and other kinds of cultures from birds to learn a lot more about them. But this is not regarded as an inappropriate activity for the study of birds.
We should talk about the pictures themselves. Maybe why were they so different? What was it about his drawings, paintings of birds that were so different at that time?
Well, there's three things I guess we should say. First of all, they were all painted at full life size, including the very largest birds. And this is why the Birds of America is this enormous coffee table size. We talk about coffee table books. Audubon's books are actually the size of a coffee table. He drew all of his birds, or he reproduced all of his birds on paper that was about 40 inches high and nearly 30 inches wide, so that one of these bound volumes would weigh about 50 pounds and again, be about the size of a small table. He did that because he had developed a specific technique for drawing birds that involved pinning them up to a board against which he had a grid, and he had a similar grid on his drawing paper that he used to get the exact dimensions of the birds correctly. He also did this, though, because he wanted to, all his life, Audubon strove to find a way to put life onto the page, to make his birds appear to be alive. And this is the second thing that's important, which is that unlike other ornithological studies that had come before, Audubon's birds were flying, and they were attacking prey, and they were attempting to escape from predators that were in hot pursuit of them. You know, before Audubon's time, when naturalists did a painting of a bird, it was typically perched with its wings folded kind of demurely against its body, usually against a neutral background. And Audubon did what all great artists do, which is that he stuck to a different vision, and he painted the birds as he saw them in the wild. And that wildness that Audubon was able to bring back from the frontier in his paintings really, really set them apart. And then, of course, the final thing that is so important is that it was very difficult, very time-consuming, and very labor-intensive to reproduce color images. This had to be done through a combination of engraving and hand coloring. And so when Audubon, who was unable to do this in the United States, went to first to Edinburgh and then to London to have his birds engraved.
And we're going
to
discuss that after a short break. We're going to take up his trip to England. We're talking about the life of John James Audubon. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about John James Audubon and the making of his masterpiece, Birds of America, a four-volume set of prints that captured birds in their natural settings. My guest is William Souder, author of Under a Wild Sky. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Audubon might never have completed Birds of America if he had not traveled abroad and garnered necessary financial support for the project. Here with us to discuss that integral part of Audubon's life is Duff Hart Davis, author of Audubon's Elephant, America's Greatest Naturalist, and The Making of Birds of America. He joins us from BBC Studios in Cambridge, England. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Lynn.
What exactly brought Audubon to Britain?
As we just heard then, he was desperate to find someone to publish his great work. And he'd failed in Philadelphia, and a kind of mafia there had put up defences against him, and he'd failed in New York, and nobody would do it. And England was his last throw, really. And until then, he was a pretty good failure. He'd had business failures down the rivers on the frontier. He'd always lost money. He'd never really done any good, and all he had managed was to build up this portfolio of huge paintings. And he came with about $300 or pounds, I can't remember which now, in his pocket, and a few letters of introduction, not to any publishers, but to businessmen in Liverpool.
And why was he better received, do you suppose, in Britain than he had been in America at that time? Hello?
He was a very attractive figure. He was a strange figure because he deliberately made himself look like the frontiersman, the woodsman, and he had his hair long. He wore these great pantaloons and a great long black coat. But it was very largely the first contacts that he had, a family called Rathbone in Liverpool, who were merchants, who there were one letter he brought from New Orleans was to them. He gave it to them, and they took him in, introduced him to people in Liverpool society, and from then he went on to Edinburgh. And he was such a natural entertainer, really. And he had such charm, and he was so intelligent and so good-looking that he fascinated everybody who saw him. And so he gradually became accepted. He had exhibitions in Liverpool and in Glasgow and in Edinburgh, and it was in Edinburgh that he found a publisher who would take the thing on.
Well, William Souder, I just want to go back to you for a moment because we leapt a bit over the experience that Audubon had in this country in Philadelphia and, as Mr. Hart Davis just mentioned, in New York. Why was his work rejected in America?
Well, there were several reasons, Lynn, but I think the main one is that for several decades, naturalists in America had been eager to take control over science in this country from the Europeans, who had been kind of regulating the naming and the classification of new plants and animals in the New World. This had gone on for quite a long time, and really beginning with Thomas Jefferson and then moving into and among a group of naturalists who were based in Philadelphia in the early 1800s, there was a concern that Americans really ought to be in charge of American flora and fauna. And so when Audubon got there in 1824 with a sort of suspicious story about exactly who he was and where he had been and what he had done, there was a wariness about him. And there was also already in place the work of another ornithologist, a man named Alexander Wilson, who had preceded Audubon by a few years in beginning production on an ornithology of North American birds. And his work was still underway in Philadelphia. And so there just wasn't room. And there probably, to be honest, there probably weren't the subscribers present in America at that point to pay for such a costly endeavor, because again, this was a project that was going to take many years to complete and cost the people who wanted to own it a great deal of money.
Duff Hart Davis, did Britons immediately react positively to his paintings? Was it a universal acceptance?
Not at all. No, he had to work terribly hard to get it. And I think one of the most striking features about him is his courage and his perseverance, because he was very short of money. And he went round from one well-to-do person to another, literally drumming them up one by one. And what he was doing was selling what he called numbers. And the number was five prints at a shot. And they were issued as they were came off the press, and he had to sell each one. And if you can imagine, as William said, they were huge things. The prints, 40 inches by 30, five of them were done up in a tin box, and somebody had to deliver them to these lords and ladies out in the country, and that was all, of course, obviously by horse and carriage, by stagecoaches, and so there was no immediate delivery. And he did a lot of the delivery himself. And I think it was a very, very narrow run thing. I mean, he got extremely depressed from time to time because he'd left his wife, Lucy, behind in America. And he wrote agonized letters to her. And I just got a wonderful quotation here from in his journal. He wrote, "If I do not succeed in getting the book published, I can always return to my woods and there in peace and quiet die, with the thought that I've done my utmost to be agreeable, if not useful, to the world at large." And he very nearly did give up. And the fact that we have The Birds of America, this miraculous great book, is just due to his perseverance and to the attractive qualities of his nature.
We are talking about John James Audubon, his life, and his masterpiece, Birds of America. If you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. And we'd like to take some calls now. We're going to take a call first from John, who's in Cave Junction, Oregon. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just want to make a brief comment on the fact that not only was Audubon a great illustrator of birds, but also of botanicals, plants that he used as background realistic and associated plans. And where it goes is valid is that he did a drawing of the Western dog, which was not identified as a separate species.
All right, John, we're having a little trouble with your call. Unfortunately, your cell phone is breaking up, so I'm just going to ask William Satter to respond to the comment you're making, which is that not only did Audubon draw these magnificent birds, but, as we mentioned before, place them in natural settings, and so the background was there as well.
Well, that is important, and it is one of the aspects of Audubon's work that set it apart from what had come before. However, in many cases, if not most cases, the background elements of Audubon's drawings were not done by Audubon. They were often done by assistants. He had a series of apprentices or associates who traveled with him, who made paintings of landscapes for backgrounds, as well as many of the botanical elements that were later incorporated into the Birds of America. And in fact, many of these original, quote, drawings are closer to collages in the way they were assembled, using different images that Audubon had drawn, as well as some of these additional elements that other people supplied to him.
All right, let's take a call from Scott, and he's in Mason City, Iowa. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Lynn. Love your show.
Thanks.
I had an opportunity about 10 years ago to watch a true artist frame a set of five of Audubon's prints, and one of them was believed to be an original. They were purchased through the Hanson Trust, the founders of Winnebago Industries. And the one had no background. It was simply a bird in flight on a clear cover. And it's believed to be an original because it was obviously weathered differently. And they seem to just come off the page at your eye. I've never seen a watercolor quite like that in my life. Truly amazing.
William Sauter?
Well, again, in many cases, if you look at an Audubon original painting, there will be no background present. So that's an interesting observation. All of Audubon's original drawings, at least the ones that were retained by his widow, Lucy, were sold to the New York Historical Society after Audubon's death, and they are still there today. But what the caller is describing is, in fact, what many of them look like, because, again, Audubon often left out the backgrounds and the trees and the shrubs that were incorporated at a later stage in the production. So I can't speak to the authenticity of that particular image, but that would be consistent with the kind of work that Audubon did.
And Duff Hart Davis, eventually, how did Audubon get the money that he needed to get this book published?
It was inch by inch and pound by pound. He just went on working away, collecting subscriptions. A lot of people started and took the subscription, the first numbers, but then they dropped out and they never completed the whole thing. It took him 12 years, 1826 to 1838, to get the final volume completed by this wonderful engraver in London called Havel, whom he found after the Edinburgh guy had freaked out. Almost all the work was done in London. And in the end, they had up to 50 colourists working on colouring the prints. And I heard from somewhere that they had no magnifying glasses, but the detail was so fine, on, for instance, on some of the feathers, that they used the broken, the ends of broken bottles as kind of ersatz magnifying glasses. So they were toiling away. And it was just by, as I say, by sheer perseverance that he eventually got to the end of the marathon. And could I just say that my book is called Audubon's Elephant, not because he depicted mammals, which he also did, but because the whole thing was done on this huge paper with, known as the double elephant format. So my book is about the gestation of the elephant, which took, as I say, 12 years and was an absolutely remarkable thing to have achieved. He crossed the Atlantic, I think, 8 times during the production. He went back and forth, went back to pick up his wife and sons, back to find all the birds that he was still missing, get them, bought a whole lot of birds from the West Coast, bought a whole lot of skins that other people had got on, in the Rockies, and eventually came back, finished it, and then finally returned to America.
Let's try to take a call now from Richard in Half Moon Bay, California. Hi, Richard.
Hi. My name is Richard Rhodes. Hi, Bill Souter.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I have a copy of Audubon that will be published in October by Knopf. So I've been looking through the documents, and I just wanted to introduce maybe a different idea about what happened to Audubon and why he went to Philadelphia. His wife, Lucy, wrote to her cousin in 1821, which would have been, what, 3 years before Audubon went to Philadelphia, that he was working on a work of ornithology, which, when complete, he means to take to Europe to be published. There's several other references prior to his trip to Philadelphia, and indeed, he seems to have gone there not to try to find someone to publish his book, but rather to learn oil painting, which he didn't know very well. So I think that, in fact, there are a number of different kind of myths about Audubon that have been perpetrated down through biography after biography that turn out on closer inspection of the research not to be so. I would add, though, that these two gentlemen have done wonderful books.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling, Richard.
Thank you.
And I guess I'll ask both of you to reply to that. Duff Hart Davis first.
Hi. If you're being cynical, you say, well, it didn't make much difference because he was going to come to England anyway, his reception in Philadelphia. But he certainly had enemies there who gave him the brush off. And that was, I think that was the final trigger that sent him in the direction of Liverpool. But maybe he was planning to come all the time, thinking that perhaps that England was more sophisticated in terms of art reproduction, which I think it obviously was at that stage.
Duff Hart Davis is the author of the book Audubon's Elephant, America's Greatest Naturalist and the Making of Birds of America. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And William Souter, what's your reaction to that that last call?
Well, Mr. Rhodes, who is a wonderful writer and very knowledgeable about Audubon, I think raises an interesting point. I have a slightly different take on it that he does. I'm familiar with the letter he's referring to from Lucy to her cousin. And also, I'm familiar with a number of instances in Audubon's journals and in other correspondence from early in his life where he talked about having some desire to do an ornithology of the birds of America. He later changed that story a little bit to insist that he really hadn't given any thought to publishing his birds until he got to Philadelphia and there met a man named Charles Lucien Bonaparte, who was a prominent naturalist at the time, who convinced him that he should attempt to publish them at once and, in fact, introduced him to Philadelphia's leading engraver at the time. So I think the truth may lie somewhere in between. Audubon was always a little bit vague about his intentions for what he wanted to do. with his birds. Even after production had begun in Edinburgh and later in London, he changed his mind often about what he wanted to do and what he wanted to do with the Birds of America as they were being produced. So there's a lot of room for interpretation here. I think Mr. Rhodes has a legitimate point, and I think alternative views can also exist.
Thanks so much for joining us today, William Souter. William Souter is the author of Under a Wild Sky, and we were also joined today by Duff Hart Davis. He's the author of Audubon's Elephant, America's Greatest Naturalist. Thanks to both of you for being with us today. We're going to turn to another aspect of birding now, and for some people, birding is a popular hobby, but for others, it's an obsession. True birding junkies spare no expense for their passion. No stretch of wilderness is too remote, no plane ticket too costly for a chance to spot a rare species in the wild. In a competition called The Big Year, diehards test their chops to determine who has seen the greatest variety of birds. Joining us now to talk about the singular world of competitive birding is Mark Omasek, author of The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession. First of all, Mark, thanks for being with us, and tell us, what exactly is The Big Year?
Well, The Big Year is kind of the Super Bowl of birding. How many different species can you see in 1 year? You can see these birds by pretty much any means possible, by plane, by train, by automobile. In one case, these guys even chartered a helicopter to see a Himalayan snowcock in the Ruby Mountains of Nevada. I mean, birding as an extreme sport, go figure.
Yeah. And so you focused on the 1998 competition. Now, the contenders that year were a pretty interesting crew. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, they were. It's the only time in history that three people have seen more than 700 species in a single year. And here's who did it. The first guy was the guy who kind of got me onto this, a man named Sandy Comito, an industrial contractor from New Jersey. Now, Sandy has his voice that starts about three floors below the basement, kind of a man's man. And, I mean, in some cases, he's on the factory rooftops. He had, like, Hell's Angels-type crews working for him. And I just thought, wow, I mean, this is what a contrast between the Miss Jane Hathaway of the Beverly Hillbillies who I was accustomed to knowing about birders. But Sandy was the alpha dog, and he spared no expense and was away from home 270 days, traveled 270,000 miles, lived for weeks on end on these desolate Alaskan isles, just waiting for El Nino to blow Siberian birds into North American airspace.
So these are real adventurers, you would say.
Well, they do like their creature comforts. Now, the island I was just talking about, Attu, which is the easternmost island in the Aleutians, is a miserable place. But I get it, you know, it's really what these guys did is a bird's eye view of the continent. And so, in many cases, yes, they did go to spectacular places like Attu or in the Everglades at dawn for flamingos, the North Woods of Minnesota for owls in the middle of winter. But then other times, I mean, I got to say, for years, the only reliable place in North America to see one particular species of bird, a tamaulipas crow, was the Brownsville, Texas dump.
All right. We're going to continue this discussion after a short break, Mark, so stay with us. And listeners, stay with us as well. Let's talk the nation. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary. We're talking about birds and birding today on Talk of the Nation. If you're a birder, we'd like to hear from you. Tell us about your experiences in the field and what got you hooked on the hobby. Our number, 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Or send us an email at totn@npr.org. With us now to talk about the world of competitive birding is Mark Omasek. He's the author of The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Fowl Obsession. He's joining us from the KUVO studios in Denver, Colorado. Let's talk about that word obsession, Mark. You talked about how your own obsession with birding began. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I kind of started this project more interested in the nature of obsession than really in the objects that these guys were obsessed in birds. I found birders to be really smart, funny people with this great sense of adventure, just this indestructible sense of optimism. I mean, you don't go from Fairlawn, New Jersey to Point Barrow, Alaska with hopes of seeing one bird, an ivory gull, and then miss it and then repeat the whole trip again without having just this terrific zest for living, this kind of grown-up Tom Sawyer part. And so what happened was I went in the field with these three guys, the New Jersey industrial contractor. Another was a big Fortune 500 executive who's now living on the slopes near Aspen. The third is a guy who was a despondently divorced nuclear power plant worker who used his big year as kind of a way to teach him joy again, to teach him how to live. And these guys were just so much fun to be around that really their enthusiasm rubbed off on me. And although I started the project in being interested in obsession, you know, what happens if you take the brakes off for a year? What if you really go for the one dream that you've really had? Being around these guys, it was so much fun that it started to rub off on me, and I went native. In fact, I was out this morning with our kids, and you know, I enjoy going out. I mean, to me, birding, there's not many things that you can do outdoors where you're using your noggin, you're using your legs, your heart, and to a wide range of ages of people. It's really a blast.
Will you say that these people that you wrote about are reflective of the birding community at large, or are they really the characters of the birding community?
No, these guys are a little bit more driven. I mean, for most people, birding is really a pretty genteel pastime. It's a beautiful way to spend a walk in the park. You know, you just look at things a different way. You know, you see these little creatures, these little hummingbirds that may just be as big as your pinky, and you just stop and say, wow, just a few weeks ago, that little bird, that little ruby-throated hummingbird may have been in Guatemala. You know, what's it doing in my backyard now? So it's really a different way of looking at the world. What these guys did, these three guys in the big year, was kind of a feathered version of it's a mad, 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 mad world. They had this big list, 675 native species in North America. They had to see them all. And then especially what they had to do in the year that I wrote about, 1998, was find these, they call them vagrants and accidentals, birds that got blown here by these freak winds from El Nino. And there are so many people who chase rare birds these days that there's actually rare bird alerts that'll call you in the middle of the night and say, hey, get out of bed. There's a whiskered tern at Cape May, New Jersey. Get out there, catch the next flight, and go see him. And hundreds, if not thousands of people will do exactly that. And that's what these guys did for a year. They chased their dream of finding how many birds they could see in a given year.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Mark.
Well, thanks. That was a blast.
Mark Amasik is the author of The Big Year, A Tale of Man, Nature, and Foul Obsession. He joined us from KUVO Studios in Denver, Colorado. And now we turn to someone who has more of what you might call a radio take on bird watching. Jeff Wells is a conservation ornithologist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York, and he makes audio recordings of birds in their natural environs. He joins us by phone from his home in Ithaca. Thanks so much for being with us, Jeff.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Describe for us what it's like to do these field recordings. How complex is it? How does it work?
Well, it's not wholly different from, you know, just recording that most people are familiar with a simple tape recorder. But what you do is you take a fancy tape recorder, you plug in a fancy long microphone or a parabolic reflector, sort of like a small satellite dish. You have some microphones, sometimes battery packs and so on around your neck. You have all this strapped to you with a pair of binoculars and your notebooks and other things, and you head out into the field, forest, whatever it is you're trying to get find the birds. And then the trick is you try to get as close as you can to the birds without disturbing them and get a really really good recording without extraneous noise of wind and rain and other things.
Now, how do you initially identify a bird species in the wild? Is it by sight or by sound?
Probably 70 or 80% of the time or more, depending on the habitat, you identify it by sound. You know, people like the folks who did, you know, a big year that was just described or some other kind of competitive birding event. You have to rely on sound, on identifying the birds by their calls and songs, because, you know, birds are generally often hidden in trees or bushes or whatever, and you hear them first.
So birders might study your audio, your tapes, then, would they?
Yeah, at the Cornell Lab, we produce a whole series of tapes and CDs just for that, so that people can actually sit down with the tape or the CD and listen to the different sounds and try to learn them.
Well, let's take a listen to some of these recordings. We have a few. Let's roll the first one now.
Thank you.
Okay. What is that bird?
That is a tricolored blackbird, and it's a close relative to a bird that a lot of people are familiar with across the whole U.S. and Canada, the red-winged blackbird. But this bird occurs only in California, basically, rarely outside of the state. The entire population occurs in there, and it. People sometimes know the sound of the red-winged blackbird as a sound of spring, the bird that arrives back in February and March, the first bird back, and it sounds kind of like okurlee. And these birds sort of do a version of that, except it's sort of really low and maybe a little ugly sounding.
Yeah, it sounds like you had to be incredibly close to them to get that sound somehow.
Yes, the person was probably, you know, within 20 feet or something like that when they recorded them.
20 feet, wow. Now, okay, we've got another. I'm not sure what we're about to listen to, but we've got a second recording. Let's hear this one. And what was that?
That was a potu. That's a, you know, you can hear how, in a way, how disturbing that sound is, but imagine being out in the middle of the night in a tropical rainforest and hearing that and not knowing what it is. That's when they vocalize. This is a nightjar bird that is active at night, and so the person recording this had to be out at night in a tropical rainforest in Peru, actually, the Amazon basin, to record that.
All right, we have one more. Let's hear this one. Now I know that bird. That's the loon.
That's the common loon. That's a beloved bird of people in the northern states, New England and northern Minnesota and Michigan and places like that, and up through Canada. It's one of their calls. You know, you sort of imagine being up in this sort of northern beautiful lake and hearing those calls at night.
Now, I have my bird story from that one, which is that I actually have a cottage in Canada with my husband, who is Canadian, and I had a relative from New York visit, and every time we heard the loon, we would all stop and say, "It's the loon," and the relative said, "I can see saying it the first time, but why do you guys have to stop and listen every time you hear the loon?"
Yeah, there's something about it that's sort of primeval. It just makes you stop whenever you hear it, I think.
Yeah, it does. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Jeff.
My pleasure.
And to all of you birders out there, happy birding. Jeff Wells is a conservation ornithologist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York, and he joined us from his home in Ithaca. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.